You're listening to BQN. Assimilate the audio.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of All Good Things, the Star Trek Universe podcast here on BQN and the Fandom Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mark White. With me today is Christos. Hey, Christos.
Hey, Mark. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Amy heard we were covering TOS and she ducked out this week.
Sucker.
No, we kid. She had things come up, but still, I had a feeling she didn't really want to record this week.
No. I'm sure it's just fine, but you know, we all get busy and have things going on. Mm. So trying to align schedules is always a little bit of a, can be a little bit of a chore sometimes.
That's true. Well, we're lucky we have you, so we can keep the, you know, the wheels turning. Speaking of, so you released a couple of What's the TBEV episodes lately. Do you want to give us some background, some fun highlights on what's going on, What's the TBEV?
Yeah, I guess we'll call it the last two episodes, which were, I guess, episodes 4 and 5, were basically a two-part series, which I did not set out to do, but kind of turned into that. Based on the New York Comic Con coverage. So episode 4 included Mr. Davey Willett. Listeners of the BQN are getting a little familiar with Davey, and he's also an executive producer on Galaxy Class and What's the TBEV? So he's our guest on episode 4 and on episode 5, Justin Parker, who's a friend of mine that I actually, new friend of mine, I should say, that I met at STLV. He has an alter ego known as Disco Dolly. So both episodes feature that really good getting to know you. And after that, I think I'm going to start calling that trekking to know you. I don't know. I'm going to coin that one. and then it pivots to extensive New York Comic Con coverage, trailer breakdown, speculation, predictions, you know, all that fun stuff that, you know, we say and none of it comes true, but it's fun to do nonetheless.
Well, one of the things that I admired you for on the last episode is your, I guess, openness to record with somebody and, you know, ask the questions of somebody that you really don't know, because that can be really challenging. Now, I've tried with It's Green on Patreon to do, you know, some interview series there, but I've been interviewing people I know because I feel more comfortable, I guess, and I've been trying to push myself to do some interviews of people I don't know, but it is a little more nerve-wracking. So what was that experience like for you recording with somebody that you don't know anything about for What's the TBEV?
I think it went really well. I liked it. I think it was overall very positive because it wasn't as predictable for me. Listeners may or may not see any difference, but for me as the host, kind of really being interested in what they're saying and not, you know, like if I had Amy Nelson on and I asked her who her favorite character was, that was going to kind of be like, okay, I'll look at my phone while she answers that question, because I know Amy so well, and so do our listeners, and we all know about her love of Deanna Troi. But having a completely new person on, it's new to me at the same time. So it's like having, it's like a great conversation when you meet somebody in real life for the first time and you're just kind of getting to know each other. So it truly is a getting to know you kind of thing. So, in fact, Justin and I did hang out the night before for happy hour, but I purposely said we can't talk about Star Trek because I want to save the excitement of getting to know you for being live on the air, not being kind of rehearsed at all. So it was fun.
Yeah.
And our friends that were also there at happy hour were very thankful for the fact that we didn't talk about Star Trek. So,
well, yeah, I agree with you there. Like, sometimes it's nice break. because we do talk about it so often. And, you know, that's what I use It's Green for as well. It's like I have interviews and talk to people about things other than Star Trek. And the next It's Green installment I'm excited about, we're going to do something a little bit different, is we're going to do like a Halloween special. And we're going to be talking about the Tim Burton film Ed Wood. Oh. And I have Casey, is it Pettit?
Yep.
From this network. He's going to be joining me for that because he's really into movies. And I was like, okay, if I'm doing a movie review, episode of It's Green, I want to have Casey on because I know he's into that.
Casey's a great guy. I did an episode of Mickey's Marvels with him, and we hung out quite a bit at STLV.
Yeah, he's a cool guy. Had you seen Ed Wood?
I have not. I mean, I guess I should, but there's just some genres that I guess if you put me in front of the TV and say, watch this, I'll watch it, but I don't seek it out.
It's a super sort of fun movie, and you see some really, really great casting and playing against cast, mostly. Like Bill Murray, for example, plays... and this is, they're all based on real people. So everybody in this is a sort of a biopic, but they're all based on real people. But Bill Murray's character is a transgender person from the 1950s. And so he has his own little arc there where he is, you know, planning to transition and whatnot. And in spite of it, like, you know, it is an uplifting sort of fun, like, comedy, but there's these moments of truth and stuff that are really, really special, and I think Bill Murray did a fantastic job in that as well, so it's worth checking out.
I'll take a look.
Well, now it's time for All Good World.
From Las Vegas to Boston, USA, to Canada and South America, from the United Kingdom to South Africa, from Russia to Australia, the South Pacific, and beyond. This is All Good World.
Each episode, we highlight a different location around the globe where this podcast has reached. Today's episode, I'd love to give a special shout out, and I'd love to visit, let's face it, the Cayman Islands. Fun fact for this week, no archaeological evidence for an indigenous presence has ever been found on the Cayman Islands. Therefore, it is believed that they were discovered by Christopher Columbus on the 10th of May, 1503, during his final voyage to the Americas. He named them Las Tortugas. Yeah. That's as good as I can get it. Due to the large number of turtles found on the islands, which were soon hunted to near extinction.
Ugh. Of course.
However, the succeeding decades, the islands began to be referred to as the Caymans, after the Caymans present there, which I had to look that up because I was like, it just said Caymans, but it's a variety of alligator for our listeners. No immediate colonization occurred following Columbus's discovery, however. A variety of settlers from various backgrounds made their home on the islands, including pirates, shipwrecked sailors, and deserters from Oliver Cromwell's army in Jamaica. Sir Francis Drake briefly visited the islands in 1586. So that's kind of cool.
Always learning something new on All Good World.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, what a cool place. That is one of those places where I could see myself really spending like a lot of time, and not just with some margaritas, but like really exploring the islands and learning about the history. And you got to imagine all of the different groups of people that have visited there throughout the centuries. So that'd be a cool place
Caymans
to visit.
Known as a place to go hide money.
That too, yeah. Well, maybe I'd find some if I went there. Well, today we are going to be continuing with our Control series. Now, this is part two. We've only had one other episode, which is TNG's The Devil's Due. Control series is based on episodes of Star Trek where you have an entity, either like a creature or a computer, that is trying to control a whole society. So that's the premise. And we continue that today with the TOS episode, For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. And in this episode, the crew of the Enterprise rush to stop an asteroid from colliding with a Federation world, but discover the asteroid is actually an inhabited ship.
Sound familiar?
Yeah. Yeah, right? Yeah, audiences might remember a similar episode in Strange New Worlds, Children of the Comet. While on a survey mission, the USS Enterprise discovers a comet is going to strike an inhabited planet. They try to reroute the comet, only to find out an ancient alien relic buried on the comet's icy surface is somehow stopping them. As the away team try to unlock the relic's secrets, Pike Number One deal with a group of zealots who want to prevent the USS Enterprise from interfering.
Yeah, there's a lot of similarities, but in there kind of lies that whole sci-fi trope, right? There's a couple of them right there, right? There's the whole asteroid's coming, it's going to destroy everybody. There's the religious fanatics that don't want to be interfered with. There's the controlling of people. I mean, there's so many tropes to unpack there. It's really easy for me to watch an episode like this and completely roll my eyes. But I also have to put it in terms of, well, when this was first run, some of these themes were still new and would have probably seemed new and maybe been more exciting watching it in the late 60s than watching it literally 55 years later almost and being like, been there, done that, you know? So, I mean, you have to kind of watch this episode with a little bit of levity and kind of say, yeah, maybe it's not aged as well, but maybe it was better 55 years ago.
No, absolutely. And there's a reason that, you know, all of the Star Trek that we have now is, you know, on the shoulders of TOS. People that watched TOS in the 50s, I mean, they saw it, they had 3 seasons. That's it. And they just, you know, binged, so to speak, the heck out of them. I mean, people were recording on whatever they could record it on back in the day and watching on reruns on all the different channels and writing letters and all this stuff to keep the show alive because these, you know, episodes and shows were really important to them. And there is, you know, for a lot of TOS, these underlying messages that they tried to get across the best they could, you know, with the limited abilities they had with budget and whatnot at the time.
Oh, exactly. And also remember, for this particular episode, we're into season 3. So NBC had really pulled back the budget on the show, and I believe Gene Roddenberry kind of already had kind of sort of walked away from it in some sense and was working on other stuff. And it was really kind of just, I don't know, spiraling out of control at that point. Season 3 is generally regarded by most fans as the weakest. And, I mean, it's got gems like Spock's brain and things in it. And,
gems?
Yeah, no, I say that sarcastically. But, yeah, so it is a really amazing, especially the way it won out, that it did survive, you know, so many years in syndication to and only exponentially grow in popularity to get us to the motion picture.
Yeah. Now, what do you think about, because we brought up Strange New Worlds, Children of the Comet, and that wasn't the first episode of Strange New World with homages to TOS. And obviously it's built into the DNA of the show. But I'd like your take on what you think Strange New Worlds, what you think their creative direction is or mandate with, TOS, and whether you feel like they are sort of righting the wrongs of TOS in some way for modern audiences or trying to almost replace TOS. Or do you think that they're sort of supposed to be in conjunction with to elevate what happened with TOS? What's your opinion?
I think they're trying to elevate TOS for sure. I think they're trying to be very respectful of the timeline, and I think we're about 7 years out now on Strange New Worlds from the beginning of TOS. Yes, they're layering in some backstory. They're showing us some of the right. They're writing some of the wrongs. Like, for a good example would be Uhura, giving her proper backstory, using her to her fullest extent, and not just having her be that person at the back of the bridge. I think that's a good example. Nurse Chapel is another one. They're giving Christine a much more stronger character. And yeah, I mean, they're taking a few liberties here and there, but it's okay. It's been 55 years trying to make canon perfectly sync up 100% for a show that has a franchise that has over 850 episodes now and 13 movies.
Yeah.
You just got to take a deep breath and say, it's Star Trek and I love it. So, I mean, I think they're doing a good job. I love it. And
what did you think of Christine Chapel's introduction in this episode, like when we first see her and she's in sickbay? Now, I hadn't seen this episode in a long time. I didn't know what was going on.
I think it was your typical over-emotional woman who has to be told what to do and basically sent to her room because she can't control herself, and it's very insulting to women.
Well, that... Okay.
Seriously, I think it is very, 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 very sexist the way she is portrayed.
So, I guess I wasn't looking at it that way, which is good. I enjoyed it a little bit more. When I saw the... that scene play out, I was just very confused. I was like, what is happening here? Why is McCoy talking to her like that? Why is she insisting on staying? Like, I was very confused. And then when the reveal happens that McCoy, it all has to do with the patient is actually McCoy and he's actually dying. To me, like, it just shows a little bit of the backstory of Christine Chapel really caring for McCoy and being upset because evidently she had just found out the news herself and wanted to make sure that the captain was aware so that, you know, maybe they could do something to save him. I saw it as she was upset for her friend. That's where I got right. it and really cared. And then Bones, of course, is trying to be coy about it.
She's a medical professional. She's doing her job. They're portraying her as being out of control, overstepping bounds, her emotions not being in check, and literally being sent to your quarters. You know, that is insulting. I mean, like, that is literally being sent to your room. And I just they wouldn't do that to a guy. They would not have done that to a male character at all, and they would not have portrayed the male character like that. So that's, once again, it's just like, oh, women need to be saved and women need to be told what to do and women need to be protected and women aren't in control of their own faculties. It's sexist, and I'm gonna die on that hill.
Well, what about the episode, it's a TOS episode where that young ensign gets like the godlike powers? What was his name? Anyway, at one point, Kirk, I believe, is threatening to give him a spanking or something. And it was just, I mean, you say it doesn't happen with men, but in that particular case, that's what comes up in my head of like, okay, they did talk to him, like, you need to, like, behave yourself and blah, blah, blah. And he did get it talking down, too. He was also a very young
man. You can give me one example, but like I said, we can go into a lot of examples, and including further into this episode. With the lead lady of the what was her name? Can see how much I was really into her. I mean, it's even more than once in this episode. Like the way the female leader of the asteroid people, you know, it's just like, oh, McCoy, stay and save me. I'm instantly in love with you, and you can do no wrong, and I'm so glad you're here, and spare me. Sorry.
TOS fans, I am trying for you, but
it's I think most TOS fans know the problem. I mean, as forward as Trek was in the 60s, and I can admit that it did a lot of forward things. It was still playing into a lot of the stereotypes and of the time. So that portrayal of women was not just Star Trek, so I'm not calling out Star Trek, but it is looking back at a TV show of the 60s, that is a problem, and it was a common theme through other shows as well. But
yeah,
it's just why when we say some of it doesn't age as well, these are the reasons why.
Well, I want to pivot for a second and talk about the opening, which it sort of starts out as an action-adventure kind of show. At the beginning, all of a sudden, like, there's these missiles being launched at the Enterprise, there's a red alert, evasive maneuvers, they have to fire at the missiles that are coming towards them, and it totally isn't where they go with the episode, but it's a really, like, they start with a bang. Like, they knew how to open this episode. I mean, what did you think of the opening? Did you like the opening?
I did. It sets up, you know, it sets up the episode. There's some good things in this episode. I mean, it does set up, I love when episodes pivot right to action or something, and we get jump right, like, you're into the story right away, and this episode does do that. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of mystery about the missiles, and I'm kind of wondering how those missiles, how long they had been, you know, because they do have to jump to warp to go to the asteroid after they detect it.
Yeah.
So were those missiles able to travel at warp speed, or at light speed or even faster? Because they are being described as kind of clunky, rudimentary, early pre-civil, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I guess it's just one of those things that you got to kind of look past, because, occasionally you still see things like this in current Trek. but it's like, so these old clunker missiles that really pose no real threat to the Enterprise, are traveling light years to get to the Enterprise, and then only to be discovered that they're old school. I think the Enterprise's shields, for example, would be no problem against those missiles. Now, they go to the ship, and what's really weird to me is, like, the missiles are never brought up again, and the Enterprise spends the rest of the episode, like, a couple hundred meters in front of the asteroid, like, kind of guiding it or traveling with it. And invulnerable to another attack, and this time it would be like right there. So I don't know how smart that was, or if it was just kind of this forgotten part of the plot that
it probably got some rewrites from Gene Roddenberry, because he liked to rewrite scripts, so maybe part of that got rewritten out. I don't know, to focus on other things.
That could be. Yeah, I mean, it's just a little bit of a, like I said, it's a little bit of a plot hole, I guess, minor, but it does for me, especially as the computer, the religious computer, whatever. By the way, there's some AI for you. It's obviously, computer is obviously somewhat sentient and making decisions and deciding what is blasphemous and what isn't, and so this kind of ties into some of the other topics we've been talking here on our weekly themes on.
There's a, this isn't in my notes here, but I want to bring this up because the discussion rolled this direction, but there is a film, it was the student film to, I believe, graduate from UCLA, George Lucas created. It's THX 1138. Now, this movie revolves around a civilization that essentially lives deep underground after an apocalypse. And there's all these computer systems that they pray to, and the computer system tells them to take this medicine that keeps them all sort of subdued and not questioning things. And then a couple of the inhabitants of this underground place stop taking the medicine and start waking up to the fact that the computers don't really know what's going on, and they need to find out for themselves what has happened to the world, and they try to escape. And there's a great part of the episode where it pivots to essentially the servers controlling the whole underground complex. And you see all the wiring and everything. And then you see lizards and all these other things crawling around in the wiring because it's sort of not been maintained for a long time. And it makes me wonder about, with this episode, whether or not actually has sentience, or it's all just been programmed that way and left in automated mode. What do you think?
So I think it actually is a sentient AI, because it needs to make decisions. It needs to react, especially to say, hey, new people that are there, like the Enterprise crew and whatnot, and know how to handle them. Mm-hmm. And it can even make the decision as to whether or not they can stay or not. It's deciding, well, McCoy gets the thing put in his head, he can stay. And he, you know, so I think there's definitely, it's really, really, and it can decide when to inflict pain and when not to inflict pain. So it's definitely thinking. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to have, here's me playing my own devil's advocate, it doesn't seem to have that whole self-preservation thing going on. It does and it doesn't, right? Because in the beginning, it kind of shocks McCoy and Kirk and Spock. And then later in the episode, they're kind of dismantling it, and it does nothing to protect itself. So I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe now that I kind of talked my way through that. Did you notice when they get into the back control room, kind of the whole, it's kind of very Wizard of Ozzy, the way they get to the pulling of the strings. It's literally Enterprise sets that have been redressed. Like the Enterprise engineering. It's like they're like engineering sets that have been made blue instead of like red and things like that. So it's, and they even make a comment to make, like, they're, kudos to them for making a comment. They're very similar to our own control systems or something to that effect, to try to explain why the heck it all looks similar. But I don't know, maybe it's somewhere between a well-programmed computer. But I think one of the criteria for life and or, you know, sentient is a desire to preserve oneself. And I don't think it, toward the end of the episode, I would expect it to have put up more of a fight. And it did not.
Yeah. Well, that ties into the B plot of this episode, which we'll call it the B plot, where you find out early on in the episode, and we touched on this, that McCoy is dying. Now, this leads him to wanting to stay on the asteroid to be happy in his final days. And, of course, the aliens have a cure for his disease, and all live happy ever after. Yeah, so what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. I think this... it's Star Trek. I mean, it is Star Trek. It's Star Trek TOS. It's Star Trek TNG. At the end, everything resolves itself. Our main cast is great. The aliens are usually better off than they were when we found them, and everyone lives happily ever after. And that's okay. I'm fine with that. Mm-hmm. It's all good, you know. I was a little annoyed at the whole plot device with the medical stuff. You know, like, oh, suddenly McCoy's going to be dying. Suddenly McCoy's going to be staying, because why not? I got a year or less to live, and I might as well be happy and just chill. And then, of course, the aliens have the cure for him. And by the end of the episode, everyone's just fine. That's television in a nutshell, at least before it started getting to being more serialized.
So, well, speaking of serialized, one of the first, if not the first, serialized two-parter for Star Trek was with The Menagerie, part one and part two, and where we have Pike, who is essentially kidnapped, I want to say, and brought to Talos to live out his final days with another beautiful woman named Vina. And I feel like that was executed a little bit better because it was a two-parter. It was less resolved less quickly.
Sure. We have it's a little bit more nuanced. And I mean, The Cage and The Menagerie 1 and 2, kind of link those all together, is very forward for the time. And talk about high concept episodes, you know,
I can see why the cage might have not been accepted at first. Not just because, you know, they had a problem with Spock looking like Dracula and number one being a female and blah, blah, blah. But, I mean, that's your introduction to Star Trek. I mean, it's really high concept and you have to wrap your mind around that. And for 1960, I think it was done in 65. So it's a lot.
You can see why Lucille Ball would have been attracted to that, especially like the strong female characters that she hadn't seen represented in that genre or much on television. Yeah,
definitely. And even watching it, they obviously saw something for it to be a second pilot to be greenlit, which is unprecedented for it to be like, yeah, you know, this isn't hitting the mark, but you've got something here. So let's go just do it all over again. That's pretty incredible in my for now, let alone then.
Well, as we mentioned earlier, the use of religion and punishment to control a population of people in Strange New Worlds was, you know, had religion being used to justify the aliens preventing Pike's crew from altering the comet's course. So both episodes, you know, Children of the Comet and For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky, both of them have religion intertwined into this story with the comet. And so they look at it from different perspectives.
Oh yeah, definitely different takes on it. But yeah, it is a common theme for both episodes for sure.
I think it was treated a little bit better with Strange New Worlds though, as far as the religion, because you see religion from definitely the negative aspects with the TOS episode, but with Strange New Worlds, they kind of leave it open-ended at the end where you don't know if the religion was actually correct, because the one piece of the comet broke off that was sort of predicted.
Well, yeah, I feel like the Star Trek or the TOS episode that we're discussing today is definitely more of a calling out people blindly following a religion and not ever questioning it and not thinking beyond beyond that. And obviously being punished if they do. So it doesn't even allow much for breaking free into other thought, because you could be killed, as we see in this episode.
Now, have you read Plato's Cave?
I have not.
Okay, so when I was watching this episode, one of the things that came to mind was the allegory of Plato's cave. And for our listeners, I'm just going to describe what happens there. So in the allegory, the cave, Plato describes a group of people who have lived chained to the wall of a cave all of their lives, facing a blank wall. The people watch shadows projected on the wall from objects passing in front of a fire behind them, and give names to those shadows. The shadows are the prisoners' reality, but are not accurate representations of the real world. The shadows represent the fragment of reality that we can normally perceive through our senses, while the objects under the sun represent the true forms of objects that we can only perceive through reason. Three higher levels exist: the natural sciences, mathematics, geometry, and deductive logic, and the theory of forms. So you can see how this group of people living in the cave would see shadows and think that the shadow was the thing, and not realizing that there's actually an object back there casting a shadow. And this is like what happens with the people in the comet, where they have no idea that their world is, you know, inside of an asteroid. They think that that's all there is out there. And here this computer is telling them, well, that's your truth, and this is what you have to believe. So it sort of reminds me of that.
It gets into the whole, you know, the Earth is flat, kind of touches on some of those other things that people have believed, you know, the Earth, you know, the Earth is the center of the universe, the sun is the center of the universe, things like that, things that, you know, time has overcome through science, mathematics, geometry, and logic. So all very Vulcan. So I think it's just really the religion. I think it truly, I think this was an episode that was trying to make a comment on blindly following religion when science can show you otherwise.
And on Strange New Worlds, it's sort of like, oh, you can look at it through science, or, you know, maybe it's religion.
Yeah, yeah,
that, so, the two sides of the coin.
It's definitely more cerebral with the Strange New Worlds. Of course, you know, TV in general and movies have become more complex and it's evolved and become, you know, they've learned through time, and they hopefully close a lot of the gaps and the cheesiness. Not quite sure what I'm saying there, but it's definitely evolved.
Well, I know you have some comments for our assimilation or regeneration portion this evening. So I just want to throw this out there. First of all, the costumes, I actually like them. The little togas that are colorful, I think that's one of the things that TOS did really well was costumes. You look at the costumes here, very memorable. The first time we ever see the Romulans, that Romulan commander, I mean, you can't, she had striking costume there. So I think the costumes that did well. No, I'm not saying the swords, because I think the swards were really dumb. But
yeah, no, I
the pretty I togas the costumes are cool.
Good. You're right. It's something that's always done very well. You know, Star Trek always kind of had that whole mid-century modern design element to it, and it was definitely forward for the time. And you know, it still looks really good. You know, some of the hair, I don't know, but mostly because most of the hair doesn't belong to the people who have it on them. But the use of wigs and whatnot were a little over the top. Mm. But yeah, I would agree.
Are you talking about William Shatner?
Actually, I was speaking pretty much every female that they bring on screen. But look at you digging at Shatner. No shade. Somebody accused me of throwing shade yesterday. I'm like, no, I made a statement, and I stand by it. Take it how you want. Let's see here. But things are not as they teach us, for the world is hollow, and I have touched the sky. Yeah, I look at us trying to be... First off, by the way, talk about a long title and maybe a little bit too cerebral for an episode title. Not that we can't have those themes within our episode, but that's a big one to spit out if you're just talking about the episode with somebody. Hey, remember The World is Hollow and I've Touched the Sky? You know that one. Yeah, that's a lot.
Well, I would say for me, I love the dialogue, like that old man's whole speech leading up to that, and then, you know, that part of it, of course, I thought was really, that was Star Trek trying to I guess be more than the sum of its parts, and I really liked the dialogue there. Now, I can't say that about the whole episode, but I feel like that guy, the actor, was gifted one of the better lines.
Exactly.
In the
show. And I think the one thing you have to remember is people in the 60s were definitely more well-read and more well-read in the classics and whatnot. They didn't have nearly all the different types of forms out there to distract them and take them away from reading a book. And they, you know, it was all pre-cable, pre-cell phone, pre-social media, pre-home computer, pre-internet. People had a lot more time and they did read a lot more of the classics, and I think so things like that were like, especially, you know, like the Socrates things and whatnot, it landed to a greater audience than it does today.
Well, I do have a regeneration for this episode, and I would say this is very striking. They beam into, I guess, the surface of the comet or the interior of the comet, and it's like as bright as day, but they're inside of a comet, so where's the light source coming from? That's kind of never explained. It's just sort of luminous.
Yeah, it's very much, first off, I'm totally reminded of the, you know, Planet Hell stage from TNG. You know, all I can liken your comment to there is you know, when they go to the Genesis cave in the Wrath of Khan, there's a big light source inside the cave, and you're like, okay, where's that coming from? How is that being generated?
Oh, you're not wrong. Yeah, I forgot about that.
It's kind of a explain that one question mark, but it is completely in an artificial environment. So, hey, might just be a really good light bulb.
Well, I was looking at the set when they beam down, and if you look on the far left corner, you can see the edges of the cyclorama, which we've talked about before on here, is that big sheet that they use at the back of a stage to project lights on and make it appear like it's a sky. And so you can see the edges of the thing, which kind of takes me out of the episode a little bit, but it's also kind of funny.
No, agreed. It's kind of some of those not so neat design elements or production elements, I should say, not design, of 60s and 70s sci-fi and even sometimes 80s. Let's see here. If Vulcans have superior strength, why was Spock so easily defeated by the guards on the surface? Yeah, it's, you know, he had to be defeated. That's all there was, you know.
They just could have, they push him, really. They push him and they wrap their arms around him, and he's just like, okay.
Well, maybe they have superior strength. Yeah, I don't know. Sure. I'm just trying to give you a, I'm trying to zhuzh this to make it make sense for you.
We'll just go with that for the headcanon.
Not that I'm ever going to watch this episode again. Right. Shall we talk some trivia?
Absolutely. Let's launch into trivia. Right.
Whether by chance or design, the music that accompanies the appearance of the old man, played by John Lormer, is the same music by Alexander Courage that is played during some of his lines as Dr. Theodore Haskins in The Cage.
Oh, so this is kind of two-part trivia. So that same actor was in The Cage, and they used the same music for him.
That either has to be the biggest coincidence, or it was highly intentional. But nobody had seen The Cage, so.
True, not for many years later. Yeah.
And honestly, who would have thought that, you know, in 68, 69, no one probably would ever have thought The Cage was going to ever see the light of day. So it's probably more recycled than anything.
Yeah. Saved them some money. Well, the field reader tube, normally used to take a medical patient's vital signs, is used in this episode by Spock to extract McCoy's instrument of obedience, and by McCoy to extract Natira's. These mark the only apparent close-up uses of this prop in the series. So
you could call this, you know, cheap production element, like they didn't create a new device to use, or we're just suddenly it has more powers than it's been given. You know, that's a production designer type of call, like, okay, we need to do this. It's in the script. We need something. Oh, we'll just use this. Because it has to be something that a doctor would normally have on a standard away team.
Well, this next bit of trivia, I'm not sure if it still holds up or not. It says it on Memory Alpha, so we'll go with it. But this episode has the longest title of any episode in any Star Trek series.
I wonder if that's true anymore, especially with the way Picard and Strange New Worlds have been going at it.
Yeah. But it was true at one point, so we'll see. Well, that's a good thing for our listener question. Is there a longer one now?
Computing. All right, Mark, why don't you give us some final thoughts?
Well, final thoughts. The first watch through of this, I did watch this episode a couple of times. The first watch through, I kind of fell asleep on, so I popped it back on another time and rewatched it. But I tried to keep as much of an open mind as I can, and you kind of got to do that, as we mentioned, with TOS. Because we are a modern audience that are looking at it through fresh eyes, and we're not looking at it through the lens of somebody that, you know, lived during the early mid-1960s. So for us, we do have to take some of the things with a little bit of grain of salt. But something that I do like about the episode is I like its connection to, like I said, the allegory of Plato's cave. I like where they were trying to go with it. I like some of the dialogue elements and some of the costumes. And I see why, you know, this episode, you know, among some others, are stand out for TOS fans that, you know, really saw the episode and saw the series of TOS doing, breaking new ground that television had not done before. And they wanted to see more of it. And so that's why they did the letter writing campaigns and whatnot, is because they were telling stories here that had a higher message and a higher meaning that a lot of shows weren't doing. Like, if you watch typical Westerns and whatnot, they weren't trying to really, like, make a statement aside from, we're going to rob a stagecoach, you know. So this was something a little bit different, a little more cerebral.
For sure, for sure. Yeah, I'm not sure how much more I can echo what you said there. One thing we didn't really touch on, it's kind of cute part of the episode, was the idea that McCoy gets the girl, and that's kind of a rarity to the point that even Kirk and even Spock kind of have, well, fine, we'll let you have this one, you know. yeah, that was kind of, I don't know, it was kind of funny the way they have it. I think for a hot second, I feel like even Spock kind of breaks Vulcan character a little bit in that scene. it was just kind of interesting to be like, well, you know what? That's okay. I've had enough. You can have this one, McCoy. Kirk's kind of attitude in that one. So let's see here. So next week, our episode tease is Fear Factor Part 1, where we'll be talking Strange New World for all those who wander.
So the timing of this episode was supposed to line up with Halloween. So it'll just be coming out a couple of days past Halloween. But, you know, hopefully you're still in a Halloween-y mood for this episode. I think everybody remembers this is the Gorn episode.
For sure.
Well, we would love to hear what you thought of today's episode and hope you'll join our Facebook group, the BQN Collective, to continue our discussion there. You can also tweet your thoughts at AllGoodPod. We'd love for you to reach out. We love the interaction. Please follow the network on Twitter and Instagram at BQN Podcast. We've also partnered with our friends at the Fandom Podcast Network, where you can find us by searching their master feed. So, Christos, where can people find you when you are not breaking into a restricted area to save an enslaved people from a computer AI?
Well, you can find me on Facebook on the BQN Collective. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at either at Greek Geek SD or at What's the TBev. And remember, you can get What's the TBev on YouTube and or where you get all of your BQN podcasts. And Mark, where can people find you when you're not playing the guy behind the curtain controlling a whole group of people through religion and little discs of pain receptors in their heads?
Oh, Lord. The things I do. Anyway, with that said, you can find me on the BQN Collective Facebook page. You can also find me on Twitter at MarkWhite207. You can find me on Patreon if you become a patron of the network, where I have a show, It's Green. And like I said, this week we're going to be covering the great Tim Burton film, Ed Wood. And so if you guys sign up, you can hear our discussion about that. Please hit the subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get podcasts and leave us a star rating and written review. That helps others to find the show. Remember, we have an exciting promotion going on through the month of October. Leave the best review you can for All Good Things on Apple Podcasts, and you can win a free bag of Grounds and Hounds coffee. At the end of the month, we will pick our favorite review as the winner. Grounds and Hounds Coffee Company believes that great coffee can fuel a greater purpose. Through the sale of organic and eco-friendly specialty coffees, they support rescue initiatives and organizations, providing a second chance for pups in need. 20% of all Grounds and Hounds profits are deployed to rescue organizations working to make the second chance mission a reality. So listeners, leave a review, win coffee, and save puppies.
Aww. At this time, we'd like to thank our associate producers, Mahendran Radhakrishnan and Tim Cooper. A special thanks to Graham Kelly for our opening and closing music.
If you would like to help us keep all of our shows coming to each week, you can become a patron of the network on Patreon. Join the Hive to enjoy It's Green, Amy's Math Moments, and other network perks. With a monthly subscription of $5 or more, you can join our meetings on the Hive Mind on the second, sometimes third Saturday of each month. Visit patreon.com/BQN to get all the details and watch your messages.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you join us as we search out all good things.
Tortugas.
No, no. Tortugas.